From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, continuing our week-long look at a century of music in New York. The occasion is New York Magazine's annual Yesteryear issue. It's all about 100 years of music in the city, broken up into decades. And we've been asking you this week which decade of New York music you're nostalgic for. Our listener Joan left this comment on soundcheck.org. The 30s and 40s took place before I was born, but I would have loved to have seen the big bands when they were at the peak of their popularity. Johnny Hodges is my idol, and so is Billie Holiday. I would have loved to have danced to their music and been hanging out with the jitterbugs. What a joyful time musically in the face of the worst economic and political eras of the USA. Cesar tweeted us that he was nostalgic for the 70s, 80s, as he puts it, and the awesome salsa times of Hector Lavoe, Fania, Willie Colon, Ruben Blades. Oye, que rico suena. Neil tweeted us about the early 70s, and specifically the historic music venue known as the Fillmore East, which I missed, he tells us. Jeff from Staten Island is nostalgic for that time period, too.
I'd like to put a vote in for the 60s into the 70s, I guess. Maybe early 70s. How about the Allman Brothers at the Fillmore East? Bill. Considered by many the greatest live rock album ever created. Obviously, these guys are from the South, but they became great by winning over New York. And of course, the Allmans still come to New York. Maybe for the last time, but they still do.
Well, the Allman Brothers Band just postponed the rest of what was shaping up to be their final annual visit to New York's Beacon Theater. Greg Allman has bronchitis. They're telling ticket holders to hang on to those tickets because they will be honored when they announce the rescheduled shows. You know, all this talk of musical nostalgia reminds me of seeing electronic music pioneer Gary Numan on his first American tour, probably 1979 or 80, at the old Palladium here in New York, and I'm telling you this now just as a way of warning you that I may indulge in a little nostalgia myself when Gary Numan joins us in just a few minutes. Also on Soundcheck today, pianist and bandleader Chris Bowers plays a style of jazz that's full of the sounds of indie rock and hip-hop. He and his band will play live for us. But back to musical nostalgia. New York Magazine's latest cover story is called 100 Years, 100 Songs, 100 Nights, A Century of Pop Music in New York. And listeners, we want to know which decade of New York music you're most nostalgic for. Post a comment at soundcheck.org or leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. And joining me now is New York Magazine's culture editor, Lane Brown. Welcome back, Lane.
Hey.
So you have chosen the 1960s.
I have.
Were you alive during the 60s, aware enough to be nostalgic for it?
I was not yet alive okay. During the 1960s. I apologize.
So why? Why pick the 1960s?
I think it was a really vital, interesting time in pop music in New York. You had 1,000 different things happening. You had the Brill Building churning out just hit after hit after hit. You had the birth of salsa. You had Barbra Streisand on Broadway. You had Judy Garland at Carnegie Hall. A million things are happening. But you also had this kind of interesting collision with pop music and mass media. And it's kind of a time when I think pop music sort of became self-aware and kind of concerned with branding and rebranding itself. And you have people like, Bob Dylan, who was this nice kid from Minnesota who comes to New York and pretends to, fallen off of a boxcar, basically, and, you know, becomes the king of the Greenwich Village folk scene. And then later, when that kind of curdles, he becomes this rock star.
Well, Dylan is a great example of what you were just talking about branding and rebranding, because, you know, during the course of that decade, he rebrands himself like three different times, you know, from the Woody Guthrie follower to the original singer-songwriter to, as you say, this kind of lightning rod of the rock culture. Let's hear Bob Dylan and a classic from the 60s, Positively 4th Street.
You got a lot I knew. I say you are my friend. When I was down, you just stood there grinning. You're so hurt, why then don't you show it?
That is Bob Dylan. That is one of his most New York-y songs, wouldn't you say, Lane?
Definitely. It was allegedly, although there's a lot of speculation about who exactly the song is directed to, but I think the most popular theory is that it was aimed at the people who were upset by his going electric.
Now, in the nostalgia issue of New York Magazine, which goes decade by decade through New York City music, you have a piece about Dylan written by Richard Alderson, the sound engineer, where he writes about Dylan playing a small show at the Gaslight, and he writes, "I've never been in a situation where everyone was as rapt. It was like Jesus had come down and appeared in the flesh." Now, at the end of the movie Inside Llewyn Davis, we get a quick glimpse in the background of a Dylan-esque character walking. I mean, is Llewyn Davis kind of an exercise in nostalgia for the music of the 60s?
Sure. It's you get a sort of a peek at this scene, and the whole time you're watching it, you're kind of aware that, you know, Dylan is going to show up at the end, and he's like this figure that's haunting the whole thing. But before that, you see back when folk music kind of meant, you know, If I Had a Hammer or
right.
That kind of thing.
100 miles, 100 miles, 100 miles, 100 miles. You can hear the whistle blow. 100 miles.
So, and you mentioned before salsa. You know, I remember talking to Willie Colon many years ago about the dawn of salsa and boogaloo in the 1960s and, you know, the uptown clubs and the clubs in the Bronx and stuff. It was stuff happening everywhere.
Exactly.
And a lot of those clubs, you know, were kind of the seamy underbelly of New York, not necessarily the salsa places, but places where bands like the Velvet Underground came
sure.
up. So now you've picked for us the Velvet Underground song, Waiting for the Man. Richard Hell writes the article for you guys about the Velvet Underground, and his point seems to be, God, why did it take me so long to realize how great these guys are? Is that part of the whole nostalgia thing?
Well, yeah, sort of. I think most of the Velvet Underground's fans are people that eventually came around to them, were, you know, sort of nostalgic for them. In that, you know, like there's that famous Brian Eno quote where very few people actually bought the album when it came out, but they all went on to sort of form bands of their own. It was 171 on the Billboard charts, and that's as high as any Velvet Underground album ever made it. Yeah, I think it took a lot of people a long time to catch on. They were way ahead of their time.
And, of course, unleashed that seminal New Yorker Lou Reed upon the music scene as well. So we'll hear Waiting for the Man from the band Velvet Underground. We've been speaking with Lane Brown. He's the culture editor at New York Magazine. Their nostalgia issue is on newsstands now, a decade-by-decade look back at a century of New York City music. Lane, good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Up to Lexington.
So, what decade of New York music makes you nostalgic? Which artists or records or venues trigger that response? Post your comment at soundcheck.org, tweet us at soundcheck, or leave us a voicemail, 866-939-1612. And our look back at the past 100 years of New York music continues tomorrow with New York Magazine contributor Jennifer Vineyard. She picks the sounds of the 70s. Now, whether or not you've experienced the 70s firsthand, you'll want to stick around for a very candid conversation with electronic music pioneer Gary Numan. He'll talk about his early success, his recent struggles with depression, and his foray into industrial music styles. All of that coming up next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This song, Cars, is one of those earworms that just refuses to die. And how could it? It pops up everywhere. TV commercials, soundtracks, there are many cover versions. You'd never know it's from 1979, given how fresh it still sounds. It was among the first of many career highlights in 30-plus years of electronic music making by the pioneer Gary Numan. His most recent album is called Splinter, Songs from a Broken Mind. It came out in October, and Gary Numan joins me in the Soundcheck studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Before we get to the latest record, what is it about Cars? I mean, at some point in your career, you must have been like, oh, I'm never going to shake this song. Have you made your peace with it?
I made an uneasy peace with it, yeah. It is strange to have something that's been that successful that you actually don't have the best relationship with. And I think the reason is it kind of overshadows or overshadowed everything that came after it. And it defines you in a way. And unfortunately for me, it's probably very untypical of the music that I've made over the years. And so to be defined by something that you think that isn't actually mostly what I'm about, you know, it's been a bit frustrating. And then there comes a point when you think, well, now that's just being childish. Because, you know, most songwriters would give their right arm to have had something that's done that well. And then I felt a bit silly and embarrassed. Like, oh, I should be really proud of it. So then I became really proud of it. And then you swing back the other way again, you know, just to and fro. But no, I'm very proud of it. I'm very proud of what it's done. But it certainly doesn't represent the main body of what I've worked on over the years.
Do you know Al Jorgensen from Ministry?
No, I know of him. Met him, but yeah, we have mutual friends.
Well, you know, he sort of has gone through a similar thing, you know, the early days of Ministry, the kind of pop electronic sound, and then going into the much more, you know, the darker, more industrial electronic sound.
Yeah.
An arc that your career has kind of paralleled as well. And when we get to this new record, Splinter, with a very creepy picture of you on the cover in the kind of steampunk Victorian coat and hat and stuff. I mean, it's, you know, there's something very, the mood has always been dystopian in your music, but it seems to have gotten more interior over the years.
Yeah, well, certainly with Splinter, I think probably more than any other album. But there's a reason for that. I did an album in 2006 called Jagged, and our second baby was just coming along, and a number of things happened. My wife went into postnatal depression, and she was having a real hard time. The change of life with having children. I turned 50, which actually hit me much harder than I ever expected it would. I had a really big. I've always been very, very close with my parents. Super close. And then on one particular day, it just fell apart. In one day, it went to pieces. And we barely talked for 2 or 3 years, and that hit me very, very badly. And all these things kind of happened very, very close together. And so I was diagnosed with depression, I think, in 2008, but I've been in trouble for some time before that.
But you were diagnosed.
But diagnosed, yeah. Yeah. And then they give you the cure, which is almost as bad. You know, it's a... an interesting way of dealing with something in that they just stop you feeling anything at all.
Yeah.
And so you don't care about anything. So I went for nearly 4 years, I think, and hadn't written a single song. My career was fading away. Marriage was in trouble. Life in general was pretty difficult. And then as you start to come out of that, you start to write again. You know, that impulse, that desire to want to write about things has happened. And you've had this 4 or 5 years of thing that you've been going through, and that's what you want to write about, and that's Splinter.
Mm-hmm.
So for that reason, it's far more emotional and deeply felt than anything I've ever done before. So,
and it sort of explains the subtitle too, Songs from a Broken Mind.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Had you ever gone through a period like that of 4 years without writing?
No. Yeah. No, not since I was... I mean, I started to write songs before I was a teenager in a very, very basic amateurish kind of way, you know, terrible little kiddies jots, but poetry and that sort of thing. No, I've written almost all my life.
Yeah.
And so to have something like that... And the weird thing about it was you're in a permanent state of I don't care much about anything in a kind of a nice way. You know, life is just drifting along and everything is cool. I was meant to be doing Coachella, the festival. Major opportunity for me, certainly at that point anyway. And the volcano, the Icelandic volcano did its thing. I couldn't get there. And everyone around me was wringing their hands and it was a disaster. And I just went, well, let's go and get something to eat. Didn't care. Absolutely didn't care. You know, and obviously I should have.
Yeah.
And now
yeah,
I do. Now I'm really bothered by the fact that it didn't happen. But at the time... Yeah, you didn't get it. And you know, that's a signal that maybe you're not right.
Yeah,
you're not right.
We're speaking with the singer and songwriter Gary Newman, the electronic music pioneer. Let's hear one of those songs from A Broken Mind. The album's called Splinter, and this is I Am Dust.
We were pulled from our path of least resistance. And the song we sang, what became of us?
Now, around 1981, I seem to recall word that you were thinking of retiring from music. You'd had, you know, a couple of hit records. Cars had been up on the charts. Mm-hmm. And the word was that you were giving up music because you wanted to be a pilot. You were flying.
Yeah, partly true. There were a number of things happened. First of all, I didn't take to the whole success thing very well at all. It wasn't what I expected, and I just found I was really uncomfortable with it. But mostly it was the pace of it. It was frantic and hectic and crazy and completely out of control. And I was just knocked back by it in a way, and I didn't enjoy it. I wanted to calm everything down. I wanted to control it more. I didn't want to get out of music. I wanted to concentrate on songwriting. But so I said I was going to retire from live work. And it just got misreported so many times. You got sick to death of trying to explain it.
Right,
so, I mean,
right.
You just go, yeah, all right, I'm retiring. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, I'm going to fly around the world in my little Cessna.
Yeah. And I'd just done a private pilot's course. So that was it. I was interested in aeroplanes, but I always had been my whole life. I wasn't turning to flying. I was only a private pilot. You know, I did it as a hobby at a weekend. It wasn't a career choice.
Right.
But it was just so badly reported. It was a really sensible thing to do, actually, to pull back the way I did. I took a year or two out and calmed everything down, and then I came back in with much better understanding of what was happening, what was expected of me, what was involved in being a pop star, really.
And at this point, at least, you're in your 20s as opposed to being a teenager still figuring it out.
Yeah, well, I was 23 when I stopped.
How old were you when Our Friends Electric became a kind of a hit?
Just turned 21. So, I wrote it when I was 19, 20, I think.
So that's, this is you with your first band, with Two Boy Army.
Yeah.
And the first kind of taste of success for Gary Numan was this song, Our Friends Electric. Synth-based sound. This is 1979. Would become universal in the 1980s. Did that surprise you that this sound caught on to the extent it did?
Yeah, yes and no. When I first come across electronic instruments, I was actually going to a studio to make a punk album, and there was a thing called a Mini Moog, a little portable synth in the control room, and I'd never seen a real one before, and they let me have a go of it, and I was blown away, and that's what changed my life, that moment. I very hastily adapted my punk songs into electro-punk songs and went back to the record company with that, and they were very, very unhappy. But I was really passionate about it. They wanted a punk album, you know.
Right,
and
right.
They'd get this other stuff, you know, so they thought they'd wasted their money on me. Anyway, but I was convinced that electronic music was going to be massive, because I just thought it made the most amazing sounds I'd ever heard. And I honestly thought for a while that I was the only person that knew about it. And I was saying to them, and we had this huge argument in their office, and I was saying to them, you know, any day now, someone else is going to stumble across this. Someone else is going to find it. And it's going to be massive. And I want to be at the beginning. I want to be at the very forefront of this, because it's going to be huge. So I did think it was going to happen, but I didn't expect it to be quite as quick. Mm. And I didn't expect to be the one that would make it happen.
Yeah.
You know, that was cool. But that was just luck. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time.
So you start down this road. The critics hate you. Your own record company hates you. But I was at your first performance here in New York at the old Palladium, and it was packed.
Yeah.
And how can I say this? You hadn't yet grown into your live persona.
No.
But the next year you came back, and it was a sea change in how you looked on stage. You seemed a lot more comfortable, and some acknowledgement of the audience, the stage show had really... So was that a process for you to kind of get into the live part of this?
Yeah, I think it took me probably near on 20 years to actually really become comfortable with it. I was very awkward to begin with. I remember some of the criticism at the time said that I was very wooden on stage. Absolutely true. I didn't know what I was doing. I used to practice every single gesture for hours before. I was not made for it. I've learned how to do it now, and now it's probably the thing I'm most comfortable with. And the performance that we do now, that I do now, you couldn't imagine.
Right.
It's the same person. You know, I'm like possessed. Wow. It's a very, very different thing.
Now, in 2000, I mean, you know, electronic music in the 90s, you know, seems to have gone off in like a different direction every month, practically. There was always something new happening. And it was hard to kind of keep track of what you were doing or anybody else was doing. But in 2000, you released the album Pure. And this actually, critics liked this. This they called a return to form.
Yeah.
The same critics who thought nothing of that form in the first place, apparently.
Yeah, interesting, huh? Oh, yeah, that's a really interesting thing a little while ago. I mean, there's a newspaper in Britain called New Musical Express.
NME, yeah.
NME, yeah. And I remember when Pleasure Principle came out, I think they gave it 1 out of 10. You know, they were just scathingly horrific about it. And yet recently they did a look back, and they're now talking about it. They gave it 2 pages. It's now this influential, innovative masterpiece. I said, really? I remember what you said about it the first time. You know? So, yeah, things have changed quite a bit over the years. I now have a fantastic relationship with the press. You know, it's very positive. The reviews for Splinter have just been phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. You know? Well, it's a great sounding record. But I want to give people a chance to hear this album from 2000 as well. This is my guest, Gary Numan, and a song called Rip.
Sick with me. I'm so sick with me.
Gary Numan and a song called Rip from his 2000 album called Pure. So at what point did people like Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails start saying, hey, let's not forget this guy got there before me, you know?
Yeah. I'm not entirely sure, actually. But the Nine Inch Nails thing, to my shame and embarrassment, had actually escaped me for quite some time. It was when I met my wife, Gemma, in 92. And she started to play me things that I just hadn't heard. And one of them was Nine Inch Nails. And I remember when I heard Head Like a Hole for the first time. She was upstairs in her room doing a thing, and I was downstairs working on something. And I heard that blew me away. And I went up the stairs as if a rocket was on my back. And just, what's that? What's that? You know, and oh, this is Nine Inch Nails. And that's where, for me, that's where that thing started. Can't take it. I thought they were the best thing I'd ever heard, ever. Most amazing band I've ever. I think Trent Reznor is an absolute genius and continues to be. Mm-hmm. And so to find that you've had something to do with that. I went on stage with him in London in 2009, and part of Trent's introduction to bring me on was saying that what I was doing back then shaped what he was working on with Nine Inch Nails. I didn't even know that, and I'd known him for a while, and he'd never actually told me that before. And so I heard it actually on stage in front of 20,000 people.
Nice.
That was a really lovely moment. You know, and I'm extremely proud of that, because I think they're one of the most influential bands ever. So to have been a part of that, you know, is a very, very cool thing for me.
Well, now, you were talking before about this album Splinter, you know, Songs from a Broken Mind, dealing with depression, and how, you know, you had this roller coaster, you had to come out of it. That kind of boost. I mean, I can't imagine what that must have done for you to, you know, to have somebody that you admire mm-hmm. turn around and tell, you know, a massive amount of people, this is the guy.
Yeah.
You know? Was that one of the things that kind of brought you back to this point where you could start working again?
Strangely enough, that could have made a big difference. But very shortly after that, my family thing fell apart, and that was the one that tipped me over the edge. So, and this is what made my wife so angry about the sequence of events, because she had orchestrated much of this Nine Inch Nails thing. She was speaking to Trent without me knowing and doing everything, because she knew that my confidence was gone. I was finished. You know, I was really in trouble. And she was actually working behind the scenes to orchestrate little things that would bring me back and pick me up and give me something to work on and to look forward to. Confidence, bring my confidence back.
Right.
And she'd done it. You know, the whole Nine Inch Nails thing had happened. We'd been to Los Angeles and done the farewell shows, as they were then. And I was feeling really good about myself, and Trent had been really helpful and said some lovely things. I really, you know, it really was helping me to feel that I did have something to offer still. And then it all went horribly wrong when I came back from that trip, the day I came back from that trip, and pushed me over the edge. And so unfortunately, that could have made a big difference. And it might never have got as bad as it got, but then this other thing happened, and it finished me off. So
that was losing the communication with your parents, who you'd been so close to over the years. Have those bridges been mended as well?
Yeah, everything's good again.
Okay.
Everything is really good, actually. But it was just a few years where just everything that could have gone wrong did.
Yeah.
And even with the Trent thing in the middle of it didn't save it, unfortunately.
Well, the piece on the new record, Splinter, the one that kind of, you know, strikes me, I'm not going to say it's my favorite track of, well, yes, I am going to say it's my favorite track on the record, is the song Lost,
mm-hmm.
which seems to, you know, it has that feeling of, you know, when you are just lost, when you're at sea.
And, yeah.
And the sound of, the sound of this piece is just really, it's intense, but not in the kind of harsh industrial way, but in, again, a kind of very interior way, it seems.
Yes.
Let's hear a little bit from Gary Numan's album Splinter, Songs from a Broken Mind. That you can walk away, but when you think back to when we first met, are you sad? Think back to all. There's a beautiful melody there.
Yeah, thank you. It's that song saved my marriage.
Really?
Yeah, we were in such a horrible place, and I was thinking about leaving, which would have been the biggest mistake of my life. And I went out to the studio that morning. I just started to write it all down, came up with a melody, and it just made me realise that when you argue a lot with somebody, you forget why you love them. You just concentrate on the argument, and you just think about the last thing you argued about, and it gets small-minded and petty, and you forget the big picture. And being able to write that song reminded me of the big picture and everything that was fantastic about her. And
and
it changed everything. You know?
Without Gemma, your Twitter feed would be a lot less interesting.
She is amazing, isn't she?
What was the latest? Something about the missing plane is in the Bermuda Triangle. And your response was, wrong ocean.
And she said, it might have expanded because of global warming. Honestly, I tweet them, not only because they're funny, but it's a really good way of collecting them. And I'm going to write a little book of words of wisdom from Gemma, because they are absolutely brilliant. She sees the world in a totally different way to anyone else I've ever met. That's why I love her so much. She's completely serious. Yeah. None of it is done for effect. You know, she just has a completely different way of seeing things. It's genius in a perverse kind of way. It's genius. It's just brilliant.
Gary Newman's been with us here in the Soundcheck studio. His latest album is called Splinter, Songs from a Broken Mind. But we're not going to end with one of your recordings, Gary. We're going to end with Dead Weather and their version of Our Friends Electric. You just met Jack White recently.
Yeah, we played in Nashville a little while ago as part of this tour. And I got invited to go and meet Jack, and he took me on a tour around his place. And he was such a cool man. I didn't know what to expect. And he was absolutely brilliant and lovely. And what he's done there with his place is just incredible.
The recording studio. And
yeah.
Isn't it all analog and stuff?
It's got everything. It's got a live room that you can record direct to vinyl from. Right, it's got dark rooms. I mean, he does everything. But it's so beautifully done. All the design, the architecture, everything about it, it's him. It was the most impressive thing I've seen for such a long time. And he was absolutely lovely. And he's so creative. And he's so clever. You know, I just come away absolutely blown away by him. He's one of the coolest people I've ever met.
What do you think of his version of your old song?
Oh, I love it. I love it. But I'm a big fan of him anyway. He's got a very interesting slant and everything, musically speaking.
Our Friends Electric, an early song from my guest Gary Newman in the recording from Dead Weather. Gary, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure. Thank you. It's cold.
Coming up, Chris Bowers. He may be a jazz pianist, but he's become a go-to player in the worlds of R&B and hip-hop as well. Today, we'll hear him playing songs from his debut album. Chris Bowers is up next. And speaking of in-studio performances, join us at soundcheck.org tomorrow, 2 p.m. Eastern, for a performance by the Brooklyn indie rock band The Hold Steady. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Pianist Chris Bowers has played with vocalist Jose James, with bassist Marcus Miller, with the great Aretha Franklin, with Q-Tip. He worked on Kanye West and Jay-Z's mammoth 2011 album Watch the Throne. And he's won the Thelonious Monk International Jazz Piano Competition. All of this at the age of 24. The young phenom just released his debut album called Heroes and Misfits, and he's here with me in the studio today with his band. And the group's going to kick things off with a live performance of his song Wake the Neighbors. Here is Chris Bowers and his ensemble live on Soundcheck. We'll be right back. That's music from Chris Bowers and his band live on Soundcheck. The song is called Wake the Neighbors, and you'll find it on Chris's new album called Heroes and Misfits, which is out now. Chris Bowers at our piano, playing the keyboard as well. Brad Williams on guitar, Russell Hall on bass, Justin Tyson behind our drum kit, Kenneth Whalum III playing sax. Vocalist Chris Turner will join the band in the next song. Chris Bowers, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Wake the Neighbors, not a bad title for a song that has even more of an indie rock sound on the record. You get some of it here in the studio, too. And that's like one of the striking things about this album is, okay, jazz pianist, but that doesn't mean that's all you do or that's all that you are.
Yeah, for sure.
So what else? I mean, what did you grow up listening to?
Well, growing up, I mean, at home, my parents listened a lot to, like, old school R&B and stuff, like Luther Vandross and Stevie Wonder and stuff like that. And my dad was a big funk fan, so, like, Tower of Power or Earth, Wind & Fire. Mm-hmm. And then at school, I listened a lot to, like, a bunch of hip-hop stuff and a lot of West Coast hip-hop, being from L.A., like Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre and stuff like that. And then as I got older, I listened a lot to Radiohead and different indie rock stuff, for sure.
Right. And so completely organic and natural, the way that comes out in your own music?
Yeah, definitely. I try to make sure that whenever I'm writing something that it's as honest to all of that as possible, because I listen to that just as much, if not more, than jazz when I was growing up.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is a kind of community of young jazz musicians here in New York, people like Robert Glasper, who works, you know, seems to move completely with ease between the worlds of R&B and hip-hop and jazz.
Definitely.
And people like Jonathan Batiste and Taylor Eigsti and, you know, older folks like Jason Moran and Matthew Shipp. So, you know, do you see those folks as doing something? I mean, are we witnessing a sea change in the world of jazz right now with what's happening?
I don't know if it'd be a change. I think it's just pocket of what's happening throughout the genre of music. I feel like there's a lot of other stuff that's also happening. It just so happens that this might be what people are focusing on right now. But I definitely think that overall the main change is that these people are adding the influences that they grew up with. Like I was saying, what I grew up with or whatever, they're infusing their music with that stuff as well as jazz. So I think it's just...
not a new thing, is it? I mean,
exactly.
Miles Davis was doing Cyndi Lauper back in the 80s, and Charlie Parker was doing Gershwin back in the 40s.
Yeah, and you had Herbie with Headhunters and stuff like that, for sure.
Right. Mm-hmm. So is there, like, one form, one genre or subset of music where you feel most at home?
No, not really. Yeah.
So how did you end up working... this would have been 3 years ago with Jay-Z and Kanye West on Watch the Throne. You would have been what, like 21 years old at the time, right?
Yeah, about 21. And I had just did a show at Q-Tip, and he had a bunch of special guests on the show, and Kanye was one of the special guests, and they were still finishing up a couple of the tracks from the album, and so they needed some new stuff on there, some new key stuff, so they just asked me to come back in the studio and add some stuff on it. So it was kind of a pretty happy accident, for sure.
Yeah. And at what point were you sitting there going, oh, my God, I'm playing music with Kanye West?
Yeah, it was pretty much the entire time. I mean, like, yeah, being in the studio with him and Q-Tip and Pharrell came by a few days. And, yeah, I just sat in the corner of the room for most of that time just kind of freaking out.
Did you learn anything?
Yeah, I learned a lot about, first of all, how much knowledge they have about music history. And they just were able to rattle off all these really obscure records that I had never heard of, even jazz records that I had never heard of. And also that they were never complacent with their position in the industry. Like they were, even Kanye, even though people talk about him a lot, he was always talking about the fact that he had to figure out a way to put this album out or put out all of his music in an original way to get people's attention, because he couldn't just rest on his laurels, essentially. Yeah.
That's interesting. You know, we kind of, for some reason, we expect jazz musicians to be music history buffs, you know, to know the lineage, to know the past and all that. And We somehow don't think of, you know, hip-hop people the same way, when to do that well, you need to know what's come before because, you know, you're building on, very often on samples and beats and stuff. You got to know where to go.
Yeah, definitely. And also to know records that people aren't going to be able to hear it and be like, oh, yeah, that's that record.
Yeah.
You know, pick really obscure things is definitely a skill.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Chris Bowers, the pianist, keyboardist, and composer. You write songs as well. I mean, by which I mean not just ABA form, but lyrics, words, vocals.
Yes, yes. Now, try to.
So do you write both the lyrics and the music?
A little bit. For one of the songs on the album, Wonder Love, I wrote the lyrics for that. Mm-hmm. But I've been trying to get a little bit better at that or a little bit more into that.
Yeah. So on this song, Chris Turner sings the vocals.
Yes.
And do you want to do that for us now?
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Chris Bowers making his way back to the piano here in the Soundcheck studio. Wonder Love is the name of the song. The album it's from is called Heroes and Misfits. It is out now, but let's hear a live performance from Chris Bowers and his band here in the Soundcheck studio.
How can it be? Can it be I awake to a dream? In the dark I search for you. For you, love, no words will do. It's something in the voice of your eyes. Something like a dove as it flies. As I try, the wonders of the world all pass me by, and all I seem to see is you and I. The spotted lands, the stones that stand, castles by the sea. Or how a child just knows love's all we need. Days go by and I ask why, yet the question leaves. So here I'll stay and wonder day and night, wonder how my love came. How my love, it came to me.
Live on Soundcheck, composer and pianist Chris Bowers with his band doing a song called Wonder Love. So, Chris, the album's called Heroes and Misfits. Are your musical heroes also people that were kind of misfits in one way or another?
I feel like that throughout history, all the people that we consider to be heroes were the misfits, you know? Like, they were the one person that decided that it was time to, you know, do something different. So, yeah.
So now we are talking this week, Chris, with a lot of our listeners and our guests about nostalgia for New York music in the past, like decade by decade. Mm-hmm. Is there a decade of music that you're particularly nostalgic for?
I feel like there's a bunch of them, but definitely I'd say, you know, the 40s and the 50s for sure, you know, the bebop era. I would have loved to have seen the birth of that, you know, Mentons and stuff like that. And then also just early hip-hop in New York, like the 80s and stuff like that, and Tribe Called Quest and De La Soul and, you know, Native Tongues and all that kind of stuff I would have loved to have been around for.
So nostalgia for a time that you weren't around for.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of hip-hop, though, there is online a really neat video of you doing an arrangement of the Kendrick Lamar song Rigor Mortis.
Yes. Yeah.
Which you do on piano and in the piano, you know, preparing the strings and stuff and then setting up a loop. What do you like about this song? What sort of attracted you to Rigor Mortis in the first place?
Well, it was actually the first song. It was a song that introduced me to Kendrick Lamar. I hadn't heard of him, and then a friend of mine showed me that song first. And so I just thought it was incredible, his you know, his ability to rhyme for as long as he's rhyming for on that track is kind of incredible.
And it gets faster and faster as the track goes along.
Yeah, definitely. And then later I found out that it sampled one of my old teacher's compositions. Eric Reed has a song on this album of Willie Jones's, and so the sample is actually from that album. So it was kind of another reason for me to cover that.
It's listeners, you should check it out online. It's a really fun performance by Chris Bowers of this Kendrick Lamar song. We'll hear a little bit of it as we say goodbye. But Chris, fun talking to you. Thanks for bringing the band in.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Tomorrow on the show, John Carter Cash joins us to talk about the release of a lost album by his father, the late Johnny Cash, plus an in-studio performance by singer-songwriter Don Landis. All this week, we're teaming up with New York Magazine to look back at the past 100 years of music right here in New York City, and we're asking you to tell us which decade makes you nostalgic, even if you didn't experience it firsthand. Post a comment at soundcheck.org, tweet us at Soundcheck, or call us at 866-939-1612. We just might use your message on the air. That does it for today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.